Welcome to Bounce, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of product teams, the challenges they face, and the incredible stories of resilience that emerge. I'm Molly Cox, your co-host, a product designer with a knack for navigating through the storms of creativity.
And I'm your co-host, Claire Flowers, a product manager who's seen it all, the highs, the lows, and everything in between.
Each week, we'll bring you tales of product traumas, those moments that test our limits, they push our boundaries, and sometimes bring us to our knees.
We're talking about career flops and follies and those pivotal moments when everything seems to fall apart.
But as we know, the harder you fall, the higher you bounce. We'll explore with our guests their toughest challenges,
the actions they took to overcome them,
and how these experiences have shaped their careers and continue to impact them today.
So join us in this journey of resilience, growth, and bouncing back stronger than ever.
Hi, Claire and Josh. Welcome to Bounce. It's awesome to have you. Josh is a product designer with over 9 years of experience in designing native mobile apps and desktop products. Josh, you've specialized in interaction design and high fidelity prototyping, and you've also worked in startups and larger companies, even companies like Facebook. And now you've really kind of been working on integrating AI and technology into B2B and B2C experiences. So we're super excited to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Molly and Claire. I'm really excited to be talking to you guys.
Awesome. I have to say something else. One of the reasons, like, I when I looked you up, Josh, in your headline, you have father of two sets of twins. So I'm a mother of one set of twins. So I can't imagine two sets of twins. So I applaud you, FYI.
Yes, it's, you know, after the first set, you know, that's something that's always kind of crazy. But then when we found out we were having a second set of twins, like, I feel like we were going to be surprised either way because, you know, you have one set and you're like, hey, well, if I have one kid, then I'll be like, oh, I thought it was going to be another set of twins. But then have another set, you're like, oh, I thought it was going to be one kid. And it's definitely made life very wild. But I feel like I just have the perfect family now. So wouldn't have it any other way.
That's amazing. But again, being a twin mom, props to you, because I know a lot of the challenges that come with that.
So. Well, props to you for, you know, being a working mother.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's not easy sometimes. So, well, Josh, one of the things, so with Bounce, we really wanted to start this podcast, Claire and I, kind of around the idea that a lot of product podcasts these days, I feel, talk about the successes in product and all the things that go right and what we learn from those things that go right. But as we all know, a lot of times in product, we fail a lot. And in fact, we talk about failing fast and doing these failures, but no one really talks about kind of that other side of it and what we learn from those failures. Now, you not too long ago actually put out a post on LinkedIn that I thought was fascinating. And it was a post about, you were similarly saying that people talk about failure, but what they don't talk about is the cost of that. And kind of with that cost, not only are we talking a monetary cost, there can also be just that very mental cost that comes with failure. I know I have my own stories of the stress and things that wrap around that. So I think to kick us off, I'm just really curious, kind of when you wrote that, was there an impetus to that? What made you think of that? Was there a scenario that happened where you felt like you needed to, I don't know, just write that post?
I think a mix of just the tech environment generally, like layoffs and everything. And then you see on LinkedIn, people, like, they just want to post what people want to hear a lot, I feel like. And I think I maybe lean a little too far the other way. I mean, you know, some people call me a pessimist, but I try to, like, call myself more of, like, a just being realistic.
We all need a skeptic.
I like to be, like, the realistic optimist. Like, I still try to see the good side of things. Like, sometimes I'll see, like, what's the worst thing in life that could happen? Like, maybe I could die or something. I'm like, well, that's not so bad. And so, like,
perspective is important.
Perspective.
But even that particularly, like, I think one thing that always, like, maybe kind of, you know, gets under my skin is whenever I see, like, a lot of posts on LinkedIn or things like mental health posts, or, and I think this one was about failure. Like, people say, oh, fail fast and feel free to fail. When you start a new job, like, you know, try to learn and experiment. But I think that people like to believe that. But that's not always true. In fact, a lot of times it's completely the opposite. And there's a huge cost associated with failure. And that's where I was like, let's talk about that other side of it a little bit. Like, you see people like Elon Musk, and there's people that you might say are like a little bit privileged, where Elon Musk bought Twitter and he did pretty much whatever he wanted with it. And a lot of people were just destroying him online, saying like, Twitter's going to fail. But he is at a stage in his life where he just really doesn't care what people think, but he can afford to not care. Like, if everyone hates him in the world, more or less, like, he's still got enough money that he's pretty, you know, independent. And there's a lot of people like that, that can afford to not care what people think. And in fact, I feel like that's kind of an attribute that, you know, people sometimes see as admirable, like, oh, wow, that person's like, they just don't care what anybody thinks of them. But again, like, that comes from kind of a point of privilege. Like, a lot of people can't afford to not care what people think, because a lot of aspects of your life depend on that. And that's where failure is, like, you know, people that don't come from a degree of privilege or something like that, they have to be really careful where they fail. And in some areas, fail costs a lot. Especially around the time, you know, in tech right now, where there's so many layoffs. In fact, even outside of tech, there's just so much pressure on people. And then you see posts like that where it's like, oh, you know, fail fast, or like, your mental health is so important and you need to focus on your mental health. And like, if you need a break, then take that break. But people, like, I have talked to people recently who have use those posts, and they're like, okay, well, I'm gonna do that. And they tell their manager, like, hey, I'm like so burnt out, I can't, like, I just can't do this anymore. Like, I need, you know, a couple days off or something like that. Or like, I'm just mentally struggling. They've been fired for that. Mm-hmm. or like had major problems. And then they're like, their takeaway is like, oh, I'm not gonna tell people about my problems, or I'm afraid to fail with these things because they can't afford those consequences and those costs of those failures.
It's interesting, because I think we get also wrapped up in, you know, in product teams and things along those lines, the fast fails with actual, you know, features that we may be working on. But you just actually mentioned burnout and like vocalizing and expressing how you feel. And we move fast in product teams, right? And it is a very real thing to burn out. And I think, like you said, with this layoff, I don't want to say layoff culture, but it kind of feels like that right now, this layoff culture that's happening. I wonder how many people are holding back their thoughts on where I stand, how I feel. And it's almost creating creating a fear culture.
Right? Yeah, I think that there was something we were talking about a couple of weeks ago called survivorship bias, about really when you only focus on the successes, you've fail to understand the failure part and what made that a success. And it's almost like, okay, well, maybe somebody did they have a really great manager. They went to them, they said, I need a mental health day. And so they were like, yeah, great, that's awesome. Well, you can't prescribe that to everybody, because it's very nuanced and it's not necessarily going to apply in every single situation. I'm curious if one thing that really spoke to me is talking about like the different levels of failure. So there's like a low cost and a high cost. In your experience, how have you been able to, it seems like when we're all like really categorizing these things, like, okay, I'm going to do this, it's going to be low cost, high cost. Do you have like a mechanism that you like filter those things through your mind and like an evaluation?
Yeah, I don't have necessarily a framework per se, but I just try to think of it like, what are the consequences of this? And I think that's and maybe kind of what's the purpose of what I'm doing too, like the consequences versus the purpose. So like I mean, you can see my little soldering station. I love messing with electronics and stuff, and I like playing with code and learning. And I think that learning, you know, by yourself, when it's just you doing something, the cost of failure tends to be a lot lower, especially when you're not like doing like messing with some equipment that's like really expensive, you can test things out and, you know, watch YouTube videos and learn. I would put a lot of those things into like the low cost of failure, but like learning more of like, you know, I think that that is kind of a category, like learning failures, where you can fail fast, learn, you code something, the code doesn't work, you debug it, you fix a couple of things, and then you learn what you did wrong. And then there's like higher costs of failure, which is like, you know, there's the solo stove ad, or, you know, maybe you're running A/B tests or marketing campaigns at a company, and there are much higher financial costs associated with that, where if you're running an ad campaign for, you know, a product feature or something like that, and you run that campaign and it does really poorly. Now, you may have run that campaign with the purpose just to see what happened. And in a situation like that, there might be a lower cost of failure, but maybe it's all about expectations that were set with other people. I think failure tends to be heavier the more people are involved in what you set and those expectations. If there's more people involved, then a failure tends to have a higher cost. Similar, like, you know, if you, like an ad campaign, you run it and it fails, then you just try something else and then you run that. And you have those costs budgeted. But if they say, hey, the company is like running out of money, we've got like one last hurrah, we've got to run a campaign and save the company or something like that, then the cost of failure could be really high. Maybe the company actually does legitimately rely on that. If that ad campaign fails, then the company could go bankrupt or something like that. But even like say in the case of Solo Stove, I think it's, I like that example because, and for people who haven't heard about this, like Solo Stove did this big ad campaign with Snoop Dogg, and I look at it and I thought it was actually like pretty interesting. It's basically Snoop Dogg saying like he went smokeless, and it, Solo Stove is a fire pit that, you know, doesn't really generate a lot of smoke. And, you know, at least from the company's perspective or the public's perspective, it failed a lot. And I think it's because their sales didn't go up and they got criticized so much. And I think that whoever like ran the campaign, I know the CEO, there are people fired over that. And I think that was like a little bit unfair, at least from the public perspective, to criticize that ad because it actually did go viral. And I thought it was like kind of interesting. And people criticize it so much saying like, oh, they shouldn't have done that. But I don't know if they necessarily could have known that. And I think that internally now maybe people got fired for a different reason. Maybe the company, like that ad costs an unreasonable amount. There's other reasons that maybe people should or could have gotten fired over that had maybe not as much to do with the fact that the ad failed or that it wasn't a good idea or not. But I think I'm situations not sure like that, familiar. It's really easy to criticize people. Before a failure happens, you couldn't have necessarily known it was going to fail. But you have to know the costs that are associated and the risks. That's kind of the way I try to look at that whenever I'm about to do something.
So a Solo Stove, was that just when push comes to shove, like the drug connotation behind it and people being mad about just the whole idea of Snoop, like why did Snoop make him so mad? That's what I don't know. Like,
I don't know if Snoop made people mad. I think a lot of marketing leaders and stuff like to show off and pretend that they know everything. And so after it failed, they're like, oh yeah, they should have known better. But right. My personal opinion on like that campaign, particularly, I think that the success had less to do or the success versus failure had less to do with that ad and more to do with like their product and audience. Like maybe you have the best ad ever. If you have a product that people aren't, that's just doesn't have a high demand, then no one's going to buy it anyway. And it has nothing to do with your ad. And so I think that there's a possibility there's something, some of that kind of stuff going on.
Scapegoat.
And it wasn't about the ad. Maybe people just wanted to see this as an opportunity to make themselves look good and say like, yeah, they shouldn't have done that when like, I mean, the ad still did go viral and I think it was one of the more memorable ads you see nowadays. A lot of ads you see nowadays are just really boring.
For sure. And I think the way you're kind of framing that brings up, I think we all have our own views for what it means to actually fail and what that means to us and maybe what that means to the organization that we're currently working for. What do you think in your experience working on specifically product teams, what commonly constitutes as failures there?
For me, the way I've defined failure almost every single time, and especially product team, is not meeting the expectations of someone else. And that's where I think that like everything really hinges on, and it gets really complicated really quickly because people have a hard time describing their expectations and laying those out. And when people like I worked at a company once for a very short amount of time because they hired me as a product designer at the time, but they didn't really know the role of product design. And then my manager, who was like a general manager, didn't have any like a lot of real product experience, and especially in much of any experience with design, was often like telling me to like do these things that were very like non-design related. And oftentimes design ends up being like, you know, somewhat product involved too, but it wasn't really any of that. And I was regularly like confused on what I was supposed to do. And then I was always trying to like realign on expectations, but no matter what, like I think that he had these expectations and he had no way of getting those expectations into my brain. And I had no way of understanding what he was saying. And now this manager had a history in the company of being like really difficult to work with, which I didn't know, you know, before joining, but it was like a really eye-opening experience that like, that when you are guessing what somebody's expectations are, you will like, that is a recipe for failure. And I think that that's what it comes down to. And it's not just with other people, with yourself. Like you have to, you can fail a lot just with your own expectations. Like, hey, I think that I'm going to try this out. And maybe it's like some big grand endeavor. And then you don't quite get it. You're like, oh, I failed, but maybe nobody else cared, but you cared because you expected yourself to have done something differently or to hit a different point. And I think expectations is, especially in a product environment, kind of really what failure sits on, if you're meeting or not meeting expectations. If you're at a company and they say, hey, we need to hit this ARR goal or something like that, and it's like ridiculously easy, then you don't have to put that much work into it. And even if you get like meet that or barely above it, you're going to feel super successful because the expectation was, it was a fairly easy to reach expectation.
And I think I hear this a lot on teams. I experienced it myself as a product manager, just constantly being in these conversations of aligning with leadership, aligning those expectations with actual end users seems like a huge feat. Have you, in your experience, developed a playbook for how to make sure that you are clear on the expectations and understand like a path forward? Have you tried anything out, done any experiments about how to help that process?
Yeah, I think that one of the things I've mostly done for like the type of work I do, which is usually design, I've started implementing a process of working sessions with people. Like it's often very easy for a manager to say, hey, I need you to do this. And they'll try to like explain it, but they have a really hard time explaining it. And when I can do a working session with them, I'm like, let's just not make this like meeting-esque. And I think people get like really burned out of meetings, but when it's a working session, technically like, yes, that is a meeting, but it doesn't feel like a meeting because you're actually just working with somebody else, and then they can explain things. And if I'm like doing something in real time, like say in Figma with somebody, I can like, you know, draw something out really quick. I'm like, oh, is this what you're saying? And then they can just really quickly say, oh, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And, you know, I think one thing I've also noticed, like, especially with, you know, product design, is everyone thinks of designers as like, oh, you're visual people. And so, you know, you need visuals. And sometimes I feel like it's the opposite that's true. I'm like, everyone else needs visuals. Like, and so I'm the person who has to create those visuals to help communicate things, which is often funny. And so that's one way I've really found a lot of progress with aligning on expectations, is just doing working sessions, especially when it's the type of work that is really ambiguous or that, you know, a leader may not, you know, be the best at articulating.
That's that's super helpful. I think that anytime that I've gotten into a working session with a designer and they're able to help me visualize the solution, it always is very helpful.
Yeah, I think also with that visualization and kind of aligning expectations, visualization is also this idea of experimentation. I'm going to go with all the shins right now, experimentation, all those things. But actually, I think experimentation can lead, the whole purpose is to lead to failure, right? But I think sometimes we can we go too far with experimentation and fail too hard? Is it like, have you ever found that to be a catch-22 as a product designer with experimentation in your past?
Yeah, I think it's definitely where people, like, you know, sometimes people say, let's try this out and see what works, when in reality, they're just trying to put a lot more pressure on you and take it off of themselves. Like, oh, I need you to do this and, you know, just find the right answer, experiment or whatever. But in reality, they don't want to be responsible for that, the success or failure, and they need somebody to blame. I think while that's not like always what happens, that it tends to happen a little bit more often than not. In fact, one time I was at a company, I had to redo the homepage, and, you know, everyone at the company wanted to do it a different way. And, you know, my first approach to things is always like, you know, what's the simplest fix that we could do to, you know, get customers like it better. But the company didn't have any product market fit at the time. And a lot of leaders from different organizations were trying to get me to do different things. And we had spent like 3 months with literally zero progress. And I was like, you know what, with me just, you know, everyone wanting to control this, I'm just gonna, you know, get one, you know, one person on the marketing team and just do it, because I'm sick of like all the politics and stuff. And I look back on it, and I did that because, like, we had spent an enormous amount of time doing nothing. And I basically figured, like, you may as well do something while you're doing nothing. And I thought that doing something was going to amount to more progress than doing nothing. And sometimes I've kind of started embracing this theory of, like, you have to let fires burn. And if they don't burn, then no one's going to put it out. And so I just did something with this homepage, and there's a lot of people that didn't like certain things, but it got changed and it got updated. And now in the end, I think that I look at it and I think there's certain things that I failed with, like the actual metrics of it didn't change really that much. Like, you might say, like, the design, if you compared an A/B test or something, it was kind of inconclusive, but it did actually say a lot about our product market fit, that it wasn't the way we were presenting the product or explaining it. It was the product itself just wasn't that useful. And that did help a lot, because then we started making more changes to the product, even though we had spent a lot of time, you know, doing those changes. And then we got, like, really criticized for that process. And I didn't, like, love all that amount of criticism, but I still felt like, looking back, it would have been hard to go about it any other way, because other people in the company didn't understand what was happening. And that had to, like, there had to be something different to happen for people to, like, get it to click, like, oh, I think there's problems in the product. And that was like a pretty big eye-opening experience for me.
How did they come to that conclusion that your design must have been as good as it could be? Cause they're like, hey, listen, it must be the product. It's not the design of the page. You know, how did they come to that conclusion?
I think because, you know, a lot of the metrics didn't really change that much. And the design was actually, I'd say, a pretty massive improvement. And I think between those two things, and I think there is a lot of pressure from, you know, the stakeholders and the investors to get some changes. And I think they realized that with all these different changes we were making and nothing was happening, that we had to actually start making changes to the product itself, and not, you know, just the way that people were, you know, their first entry point into the product.
Marketing only goes so far.
It's true. I think you said something else that actually sparked a thought in me is just manage back to expectations, managing those expectations. We always talk about the user and the business, right? And we have to manage those two things. But at some points, something can actually be successful with the users, but it does not meet the expectation of those you work with, your boss, business expectations, and therefore is considered a failure, right? So it's met the objective of the user. We've listened to the user. We've put everything in there that we've needed to put in there. But objectively, from whomever it may be internally, it is actually a failure. And that those things are very hard to control. So it's almost like we have to balance three things, right? We have to balance the user needs, the business needs, and our boss's needs. You know?
Yeah, no, that's yeah. definitely true. And that can be really tricky to balance that.
Yeah.
One thing you said, Molly, recently that I've been thinking about, and I think that it was about essentially how sometimes, I don't think that this is specific to product designers, but you were saying that junior designers can often be more confident and be more like willing to try things and, you know, and experiment. And then sometimes more senior designers are less confident in what they're doing. And it kind of makes sense for why it's like that. It's because you've been slapped in the face for years and years. But I think that is that not what experience is? It's just like a culmination of your failures and learnings, and it's what makes you good. It's, you know, the good thing is you've already made those mistakes. And so, you know, as opposed to someone who has less experience, they don't know what they don't know. So
yeah, it's funny, Claire, after we had that conversation, I actually went back and looked that up. Josh, we had this conversation. I was like, I know there's a name for this, and I couldn't think of it. It's the Dunning-Kruger effect. Have you heard of the, yeah, where, yeah, the more experienced you are, the actually sometimes less confident you become, because you simply know what you don't know. And the more junior you are, the more confident you are, because you don't know what you don't know at that point, you know. So I think sometimes that's why maybe we get safer as we get a little more experience, just because of all the things we know we are not accounting for, I guess.
And I think this goes back to something that you said earlier, was all about mitigating risk, understanding risk, like the low cost items and what the risk is for making that decision, or the, if it's a high cost. And I think that's really important to be good at in this profession of product, is to really understand where the risks are and if it is worth taking. You know, you hear about so many risky product decisions that get like all this press, and they did so well, but you know, it at the end of the day, sometimes it feels like gambling a little bit, because we're building new products sometimes that don't exist, and you don't, you know, you're building the plane as you're flying it, and I feel like there's definitely an art to understanding what risk you're being willing to take. And a lot of times you don't have the time to be able to evaluate risk. So I think that is a key skill.
Yeah. In fact, it kind of makes me think of whenever I hear people think about like risk and like in small amounts of risk, it always makes me think of like A/B tests. And A/B tests has kind of become a trigger word for me, because I feel like A/B tests is always like a cop out for, you know, a leader seeing like designs and not wanting to either make a decision or just like trying to like try, you know, very trivial things out. Typically it's like, hey, let's, you know, move this button over here or change a different border radius. And I'd say 90% of A/B tests I've seen have been like inconclusive or something like that. Because at the end of the day, I'm like, why are we A/B testing this? Like, we should be A/B testing like this totally separate idea and that totally separate idea and seeing which one works better. Not like, pre-product market fit testing like shades of colors. And the majority of A/B tests I've seen have been all like, you know, testing these really trivial changes on pre-product market fit projects. And I've always like, I think that, you know, that aspect of A/B tests has always kind of like triggered me. But also, like, I think with design especially, like, I think designers can just be so pretentious and think that like visual design especially, like I think visual design is a trigger word for me too, because like everyone is always like, oh, it's gotta be perfect and all this stuff. But like at the end of the day, I think there is a degree, like a product has to look good. And there is a the visual design of a product can be a differentiator between one to another, but usually that's like with extremes. Like if there's a product that's just like really bad versus a product that like just totally nails it. But I think most situations, users and people don't care that much. As long as visual design isn't like atrocious or something, users don't care. They just want the product to work. And I think those two things, like the A/B testing trivial changes and going so hard on visual design on a product that just like fundamentally like doesn't have good product thinking behind it. I have seen designers spend so much time like making something look pixel perfect, just like an Apple product or something. But the thinking behind it is just terrible and just not even useful. And like, did you think about any of the user problems with this, or like how this is like any different than anything else? And oftentimes, like, you know, people think visual design supersedes those, or A/B testing is gonna get them those answers, when really in reality you have to fail at bigger extremes. And I think people maybe have become so risk averse that they have chosen to take those smaller risks when there's like a much lower payout. And especially in certain situations, they're perceived as smaller risks, when in the long term, they're much, much higher risks.
Yeah, that's so. I come from the, and I know Claire does too. I come from the agency side, like, right? So I will omit age here, but years ago, I worked for an agency, and I knew I was probably a product designer when most of the designers talked about aesthetic over functionality. And I was always rallying functionality over aesthetic, and I knew I just didn't belong.
That, you know, that sounds a lot. I've got a history in agency as well. And so, yes, I can very much relate to that.
They told me to basically get out of there.
Yeah. I witnessed one time, I was like more a project manager at an agency, and I witnessed a product, I called them digital designers, a product designer, and then like a more senior creative director come to blows about like this website design. And the creative director wanted it to be this, like this new thing that's never been seen on the web before. And then the digital designer was like, this doesn't work. It's bad for performance. It actually has some accessibility issues. But I always just grab some popcorn for those conversations. Okay. You mentioned something about, did you use the word trigger? Did you say that you were
triggered? Yeah, I've got a lot of triggers.
Okay. So I want to ask you.
A lot too, Josh. Don't worry. Claire knows my buttons.
They're all from me. I mean, they're all from people who do what I do. So I read one of your posts about the concept of an MVP has become such an excuse in tech for putting little effort in, cutting down on required thinking, and shipping unfinished features. And this just really spoke to me in the way that is probably not what the intent was. I was talking to somebody earlier, and I was like, basically any new feature I'm considering the MVP. And so I read this post and I was just like, huh, I want him to say more about that. So is that word MVP in fact a trigger for you?
I think so. Oftentimes, yes. And I think people use it wrong. They're like, hey, what's the MVP? And they try to think about exactly what you're saying, like the minimum amount of work they can put into it. But oftentimes it kind of circumvents like the user problems. And I think that's where you see like so many startups like, oh, I've got this idea, let's just do it. And they don't think hard enough about like the user problems, and like, hey, what's the general user problem area, let's just create something. But they're often like just creating like just the same product that somebody else has with little differentiation. And it's because the product wasn't viable. It's like, sure, it was a minimum product, but, and I think of it like the evolution of phones has like, so the first phones were, you know, you have your phone on the wall, and then what replaced that? It was like cordless phones with the dials or like cell phones, and they had, you could text, but you could still call. So the minimum viable product was something that could make a phone call, but then they added texting, so it could still make a phone call. And then the next evolution was like smartphones. Okay, well, it has to make a phone call, and then it also has to be able to text. and then we can add more things. But if it didn't, if they would have made a phone that like a smartphone and it made calls but it didn't text, then it wouldn't have been viable. And so you have to look at the space you're in, and you have to meet all the user's expectations for that problem, and then you can solve the other thing. You have to fully replace whatever you're trying to replace, and then add what you want the solution to be. And what I think oftentimes happens is, like, they're like, okay, well, this is the problem they have, and so they do that. But there's a bunch of other features that people expect to be there, which aren't. And I think that's what's happening, like the humane AI pin or the rabbit thing. They're trying to, I think the rabbit device particularly, like, I've seen some areas in their marketing that are like, you know, trying to replace phones or something. And that just the nature of that device is so similar to a phone that people aren't going to want to have both of those, which means that you've got like a threshold that you've got to be up to. And if you're not meeting that, then you're going to have some issues.
For sure.
Yeah, I agree 1,000%. I worked on a project recently where it was something that was pretty much table stakes that all of our competitors offer. And so it was something we were trying to solve a specific customer segment that we were going after. And it was a lot of work, you know, there was a lot of things that we had to lay groundwork for. And it's really hard for me as a product manager, because I know the groundwork, like the requirements, it has to call, it has to text. Well, we don't have text yet, but you want me to be able to, like, you know, like send voice notes to people. Well, we got to be able to do text messages first. It's really hard as a PM to not chase those like shiny new, and you have to kind of like keep it to basics and not lose sight of that.
Yeah. Josh, Claire asked me, we had an episode where she was asking me my gripes about PMs. There's one, Claire. Here's a gripe. Phase two. That is a gripe of mine. The biggest myth in software is phase two.
I can't even tell you.
What do you mean? Phase two never happens?
Phase two's never happened.
Never in the history. Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like that becomes kind of the go-to, right, for MVP is, we'll hit that in phase two. It's like, well, where's that roadmap? See, Claire,
hey, listen,
you're laughing nervously.
We just finished a phase two on this project.
You're right.
But phase twos do often die. I have killed them myself, and it's terrible. It's not fun. Awesome.
So, you know,
No, go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, one thing that I've been working on a project lately, and it's been like such a breath of fresh air, because we were talking recently, and I think everyone kind of had this like aha moment. Like, I think a lot of companies are like, hey, we got to design and build. And we're kind of at a pre-product market fit with this project, that everyone's like, wait, why? And in fact, I really love what one of the engineers said, like, we should not be just building things. Like, in fact, I like to think I'm a fairly fast designer and can do some pretty interactive prototypes. And they're like, this is literally what we've, like, they're like, this is what we got Josh here doing, is like, he can design all this stuff, we can test it, and it's so low cost, so low risk. And sure, maybe it takes us a little while, but like building all these things in the product just wastes a bunch of time, and we can fix bugs and do other things with our engineering time. And you should be like designing like crazier things and just testing it. Like, the design cycle should be way longer and testing more, and not be wasting so much time like prepping projects for delivery and spending more time like experimenting with different ideas and testing those out, because it's so low cost and so low risk that once the ideas start resonating with people, then we've like hit gold, and then we can start building that. But like, there's like, I can't tell you how many products and things I've worked on that they're just, the engineers are just building it, and like, we don't even know if this is like really going to work. And you'd rather, in fact, even when I've interviewed at companies, they're always like, you know, we ship fast and we come up with ideas fast. And I get that. Yes. But they also do it almost like there's some metrics, like the fact that you built and shipped something means something, even if it doesn't like have that much of an impact. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people need to not be as afraid of like longer design cycles sometimes, and doing more wild ideas. Like, I think creativity has like, people want to be creative, but I think a lot of companies don't, and they expect them to be creative, but they don't want them to have the environment that you know, that culture that really breeds creativity.
Yeah. So instead, we will A/B test a 6 pixel there you radius go. Yeah. versus an 8 pixel radius, right? You know, so Josh, I want to ask you this. I love this. I could go so deep on this conversation, but I want to wrap this back around to kind of failure real quick and that cost. And one thing that we love asking everyone who comes on this show is, can you think of a project or a situation where you have failed miserably? And miserably can be awful, or like a small failure can be, you can feel miserable about a small failure. So is there a time you've had in your career? And if so, what was the cost of that?
Yeah, I think that there's one role that I had, and I think we were kind of talking about like hiring and stuff earlier. And, you know, one of the first times that I was hiring in my career, I think I just got kind of lucky, and I hired somebody that they're just amazing. They're just a really good hire. And I'd followed, you know, I think some good principles with that, but ultimately I think that mostly ended up being me getting pretty lucky with that. And I also didn't have like a crazy amount of pressure to get them. Like I was able to spend a decent bit of time. And so the second time in my career, where I was involved in hiring, I made some bad hiring decisions, and a lot of it was because I had so much pressure. It's like from the CEO and, you know, some of the leadership, like we have to have a designer, like, you know, more designers like a month ago. And it was like constantly being like shoved down my throat that we need this. And I had been interviewing a ton of people at a time. I didn't have, you know, at the time with that company, they weren't a very successful company. So we really didn't have a whole lot of draw for like really good candidates. And I had a lot of really terrible people. And then one of those individuals, I just got a lot of pressure from one of the VPs to hire them. And so I did, and they did do okay for a little bit, but then they started undermining me. And they were like, this individual was the single worst hire I'd made in my whole career. And it cost me my job at that time too. And I look back on that and I'm like, you know what? I think that like, it really sucked everything that happened, but I think those are some situations you can't, I think one of the things that I hear, like I've seen on people post a lot too, like especially with hiring, like, oh, hire fast, fire fast. But I, when this happened to me, I realized that is not a thing. There's no such thing as hire fast, fire fast. It's you make a hire and you're almost getting married to that person, and you have to have an insane amount of documentation and stuff to part ways with that person, and to the point where you can't just like hire fast and fire fast. And so I learned that with this situation. I also learned that if you like, you're the expert, you know what you're doing. Don't let somebody who doesn't know what you're doing tell you what to do, because you will be pressured into making wrong decisions. And those are, I think, kind of some of the top lessons I learned from that. And also just like how important hiring is. There's a lot more pressure than they say. And so I think that at the end of the day, like I learned something from that. And I think every failure you have, you can learn something from it. And, people that you like, you can learn things from, and people you don't like, you don't have to learn, from just mistakes you make or successes. Like you can learn from, everyone has something that you can learn from them, and everyone has a failure or your own failures that you can learn from. And so taking those and being better from that, that is what really translates failure into success, is, and as bad as it can be, like losing your job, losing a ton of money, like no matter what you can lose, it can be really bad, but there's always something you can change and learn about that and be better.
Well said. Hear, hear.
I love that. I was going to ask more questions, but I think that is like a...
In fact, so, you know, some of the most valuable lessons I've learned were from people that I didn't like and didn't respect. Me too. But just because you don't like or respect somebody doesn't mean that they, like, if they say like, hey, you should save money for rainy day just because they're a dumb or terrible person doesn't mean that's not bad. That's not good advice.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I think some of the people I have learned absolutely the most from are those that I don't want to be. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of my leadership mantra comes from my history and my career of different kinds of leaders all across the way, and just taking note and cataloging what I don't want to be versus what I do want to be sometimes.
I like to think I'm that for somebody.
For somebody, Claire. just to bookend what you said about hiring, I wish, you know, especially with the market right now in design, Claire, in product in general, but product design very specifically for a lot of different reasons right now, infiltration of boot camps, all kinds of different things. There's just very large hiring pools. The chatter right now is really that, you know, the process to get a job takes way too long and there's so many candidates. But to your point, Josh, you know, sometimes I wish the tables could just turn and candidates could see what we see on our side and all the things that we have to do on our side. And you're absolutely right. You make that one wrong hire, it could cost you your job. It could cost you your team. So not only could maybe you not go, but if I bring in that one person and I introduce toxicity into the team, I could have two other team members walk away because they don't want to work under those conditions anymore. So we have to be, you know, slow to hire or fast to fire. Fast to fire does not exist. I'm 1,000% with you. But we have to, I think we have to be methodical and ensure we're bringing those right people in, because it has a massive impact on not just us, but our team as well. So, cool. All right. Well, with that, Josh, this was an awesome conversation. So much to think about on this. In fact, we're going to invite you back for a part two to go further into this MVP conversation.
Okay. Molly just wants to talk about her gripes. Okay.
I do.
I love listening to complaints. And so, yeah,
I like telling Claire what makes me mad that she does. So one day Claire will have a whole episode where you can gripe on me. So
it's fine.
But anyhow, Josh, it is such a pleasure. So many insightful things that you gave us today. And very last question before we get off, what are you watching? Do you watch TV? And if so, what are you watching on TV right now? What's your go-to?
Oh, yes. I like to watch a little bit of everything. Right now we're watching the Alien, Resident Alien.
Is that Can we say that word on here?
It's on Peacock.
No one's watching this.
My wife and I love comedies, and we thought it was gonna be a comedy. And it started out as more of a comedy, and then it starts getting a little bit more drama, but we really love our comedy shows.
Awesome.
And I guess we've been watching a little bit of Abbott Elementary. My wife she used to be a school teacher too, so that one's a really good one.
I've heard among teachers that show is really slaps.
Yeah.
Those
among all the kids shows that my kids are always making me watch, like Bluey and
Mickey Mouse. Bluey. We're in Henry Danger right now. So yeah. Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, thank you again, Josh. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you guys as well.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, be sure to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you'd like to connect with us, check out our website at bouncepodcast.com.